Clark could almost credit the superstition. So struck was he by uncanny waves of familiarity, as if he had been here before, sometime long ago. With that thought, his eyes seemed to adjust, to open up, letting the muddle of swirling hues blossom into mirage canyons, figment valleys, ghost cities, and even whole phantom civilizations, vaster than the greatest Bowyer sites. Then, just as he was starting to enter fully into the experience, the blur of illusion suddenly ended, cut off as the spectral flow plunged into the sea. Besh banked the craft again, and soon the sweeping domain of color vanished like a dream, replaced on the left by a more normal desert of windswept igneous rock. The line of crashing surf became like a fabled highway, pointing toward lands unknown. Lark fumbled to unfasten his seatbelt, moving across the aisle to stare over the great ocean. So vast, he thought. Yet this was nothing compared to the immensities Ling and her comrades spanned with hardly a thought. His eyes peered in hopes of spotting a camouflage dross hauler, its gray-green sails slicing the wind, bearing sacred caskets to their final rest. From this height, he might even glimpse the midden itself, dark blue waters of forgetfulness, covering a plunge so deep that its trench could take all the arrogant excesses of a dozen mighty civilizations and still bless them with a kind of absolution, oblivion. They had already dashed beyond the farthest of Lark's lifetime travels, seeking data for his ever-hungry charts. Even looking with a practiced eye, he found few scattered traces of sapient habitation, a Hoonish fishing hamlet, a red Kewan rookery, tucked under rocky clefts or bayou root canopies. Of course, at this speed, something important might sweep by in the time it took to switch windows, which he did frequently as Besh rolled the craft, playing instruments across both shore and sea. Even those few signs of settlement ceased when they reached the rift, crossing a few hundred arrow flights west of the distant hatchet shape of Terminus Rock. A series of towering cliffs and deep subsea canyons split the land here. Jagged promontories alternated with seemingly bottomless fingers of dark sea, as if some great claw had gouged parallel grooves almost due east to form a daunting natural barrier. Dwelling beyond this border labeled you an outlaw, cursed by the sages and by the holy egg. But the alien flyer made quick work of the realm of serrated cliffs and chasms, dismissing them like minor ruts across a well-traveled road. League after league of sandy scrublands soon passed by, punctuated at long intervals by stark fragments of ancient cities, eroded by wind, salt, and rain. Explosions and pulverizing rays must have shattered the mighty towers just after the last Bowyer tenant turned off the lights. In time, the ceaseless churning of the Midden and its daughter volcanoes would grind even these sky-stabbing stumps to nothing. Soon the skyboat left the continent altogether, streaking over chains of mist-shrouded isles. Even Dwyer never dreamed of going this far. Lark decided not to mention this trip to the lab without discussing it first with Sarah, who understood tact and hurt feelings better than either brother. Then reality hit home. Sarah's back in Dolo. Dwyer may be sent off east, hunting Glavers and Sooners, and when the aliens finish their survey, we all may meet our end, far from those we love. Lark sank into his seat with a sigh. For a while there, he had actually been enjoying himself. Damn memory for reminding him the way things were. For the rest of the trip, he kept low-key and businesslike. Even when they finally landed near forests, eerily different from those he knew, or while helping Ling haul aboard cages filled with strange, marvelous creatures. Professionalism was one pleasure Lark still allowed himself, a relish for studying nature's ways. But there remained little zest or wonder in the thought of flying. It was after nightfall when Lark finally shuffled back to his own shabby tent near the glade, only to find Harulan waiting there with news. The low, massive figure took up fully half the shelter. At first, standing in the entry with only dim moonlight behind him, Lark thought it was Uthan, his friend and fellow naturalist. But this Cowan's ash-colored carapace wasn't scarred from a lifetime digging into Jijo's past. Harulan was a bookworm, a mystic who spoke with aristocratic tones, reminiscent of gray queens of old.
"The zealots sent a message," the heretic leader announced portentously, without even asking Lark about his day.
"Oh? Finally? And what do they say?" Lark dropped his day pack by the entrance and sagged onto his cot.
"As you predicted, they desire a meeting. It is arranged for tonight at midnight."
Echo whispers of the final word escaped speaking vents in back as the Cowan shifted his weight. Lark suppressed a groan. He still had a report to prepare for the sages, summarizing everything he'd learned today. Moreover, Ling wanted him bright and early the next morning to help evaluate the new specimens. And now this? Well, what can you expect when you play games of multiple loyalty? Old-time novels warn how hard things can get when you serve more than one master. Events were accelerating. Now the rumored secretive rebel organization had finally offered to talk. What choice had he but to go? "All right," he told Harulan. "Come get me when it's time. Meanwhile, I have work to do." The gray Cowan departed silently, except for a faint clicking of claws on the rocky trail. Lark struck a match that sputtered rank fumes before settling enough to light his tiny oil lamp. He unfolded the portable writing table Sarah had given him when he graduated from the Roni school, what seemed a geologic age ago. Pulling out a sheet of his father's best writing paper, he then shaved black powder from a half-used ink stick into a clay mortar, mixed the dust with fluid from a small bottle, and ground the mixture with a pestle till all the lumps were gone. Lark used his pocket knife to sharpen his tree staller quill pen. At last, he dipped the tip into the ink, paused for a moment, and began to write his report. It was true, Lark realized later, during a tense conclave by the wan opal glow of Torgon, the second moon. Tentatively, suspiciously, the zealots were indeed offering alliance with Harulan's loose-knit society of heretics. Why? The two groups have different aims. We seek to reduce, then end our illegal presence on this fragile world. The zealots only want the old status quo back, our hidden secrecy restored, as it was before the raider ship came, and perhaps a few old scores settle along the way. Still, envoys of the two groups gathered in the dead of night, near a steaming fumarole, by the winding path leading to the silent nest of the egg. Most of those in the conspiracy wore heavy cloaks to hide their identities. Harulan, who was among the few still to possess a functioning rauk, was asked to remove the squirming symbiont from his sensory cupola, lest the delicate creature burn itself out in the atmosphere of strained intrigue. creatures of the great peace, Rauk were not suited for times of war. Or is it because the zealots don't want us to see too much? Lark pondered. Not for nothing were Rauk called the mask that reveals. Their near-universal hibernation was as troubling as the heavy silence of the egg itself. Before starting, the zealots first cracked open several jars, releasing swarms of privacy wasps around the periphery, an ancient ritual whose origins had been lost, but that now made earnest sense after discoveries of the last few days. Then the Urish spokesman for the Cabal stepped forward, speaking in Galactic II.
Your association sees opportunity in the greatly lamented coming of these felons, she accused.
The whistles and clicks were muffled by a cowl, obscuring all but the tip of her muzzle. Still, Lark could tell she wasn't many seasons past a middling, with at most one husband pouched under an arm. Her diction implied education, possibly at one of the Plains Academies, where young Urs, fresh from the herd, gathered within sight of some steaming volcano to apprentice in their finest arts. An intellectual, then, all full of book learning and the importance of her own ideas. Yeah, a part of him answered honestly. In other words, not too different from yourself. Harulan answered the rebel's challenge, making a political point by speaking Anglic.
What do you mean by that strange proposition? We mean that you perceive in these disliked, unwelcome aliens a chance to see your ultimate goals fulfilled.
The Urs stamped a foreleg. Her insinuation sent angry murmurs through the heretic delegation. Yet Lark had seen it coming. Harulan's gray carapace rocked an undulating circle, a traiki gesture, which the ringed ones called objection to unjust impeachment.
You imply that we condone our own murder, and that of every sapient on Jijo.
The Urish conspirator imitated the same motion, but in reverse. Reiteration of indictment.
I do so emphatically imply. I do so in brutal frankness mean. All know this is what you heretics misguidedly desire.
Lark stepped forward. If the zealot's murmur included any anti-human slurs, he ignored them. That is not, negation reiterated, what we desire, Lark complained, garbling the qualifier trill phrase in his haste to speak up. There are two reasons for this, he continued, still struggling in Gal too. First among our grounds, for rebuttal, is this. The aliens, greedy to extreme fault, must not only eliminate all sapient witnesses to crime, to theft, who might testify in a galactic court. They must also wipe out the native stock of any unlucky species they steal from Jijo. Otherwise, how embarrassing would it be someday when the foolish thieves announce their adoption of a new client race, only to be confronted with proof that it was stolen from this world? For this reason, they must exterminate the original population when they depart. This we, in righteousness, cannot allow. Genocide of innocent life is the very crime our group was, in selfless righteousness, formed to fight. Harulan and the other heretics shouted approval. Lark found his throat too dry to continue in Galactic II. He made the gesture. Now he switched to Anglic. But there is another reason to resist being slaughtered by the aliens. There is no honor in simply being killed. Our group's goal is to seek agreement, consensus, so that the six shall do the right thing slowly, painlessly, voluntarily, by means of birth control. as an act of nobility and devotion to this world we love.
The effect, in the end, would be identical,
the Irish speaker pointed out, slipping into the same language Lark used. Not when the truth is finally revealed, and it will be some day when this world has new legal tenants who take up the common hobby of archaeology. That statement triggered confused silence. Even Harulan rotated his cupula to stare at Lark.
Explain, please.
The Irish rebel bent her forelegs, urging him to continue.
What difference will archaeology signify once we and all our descendants are long gone, our hoof bones littering the wallows of the sea?
Lark drew himself up, fighting fatigue. Eventually, despite all efforts to live by the scrolls and leave no permanent marks, this story will someday be told. A million years from now, or 10, it will become known that a society of Sooners once dwelled here, descendants of selfish fools who invaded Jijo for reasons long forgotten, beings who nonetheless transcended their ancestors' foolishness, teaching themselves where true greatness lies. That is the difference between seeking dignified self-extinction and being foully murdered. For honor's sake, and by all the blessings of the egg, the choice must be ours, every individual's, not imposed on us by a pack of criminals. Harulan and his other friends were clearly moved. They shouted, hissed, and umbled fervent support. Lark even heard some approving murmurs among the cowled zealots. Without benefit of Rauk, he could tell he was managing to sound convincing, although deep inside he scarcely believed his own words. Ling's bunch don't seem to fear archaeological hobbyists of some future eon. In fact, Lark didn't give a damn either whether some obscure historical footnote said nice things about the Six far in the distant future. Good laws don't need rewards or recognition to make them right. They're true and just on their own account and should be honored, even if you know that no one else is watching, even if no one ever knows. Despite all the well-recited flaws of galactic civilization, Lark knew the rules protecting fallow worlds were right. Though he'd been born flouting them, it was still his duty to help see to it they were obeyed. Contrary to his own words, he had no objection, in principle, to Ling's bunch eliminating local witnesses, if the means were gentle. Take a gene-tailored plague, one leaving everyone healthy but sterile. That might handle their witness predicament and solve Jijo's problem as well. Ah, but Lark also had a duty to oppose the Raiders' gene-stealing scheme. That, too, was a violation of Jijo, not unlike rape. With the sages apparently waffling, only the zealot conspiracy seemed willing to fight the alien threat. Hence Lark's impassioned lie, meant to build trust between two very different radical bands. He wanted a coalition with the zealots for one simple reason. If there were plans afoot, Lark wanted a say in them. Cooperate for now, he told himself as he spoke on, using his best oratorical skills to soothe their suspicions, arguing persuasively for alliance. Cooperate, but keep your eyes open. Who knows? There may come a way to accomplish both goals with a single stroke. Asks.
The universe demands of us a sense of irony. For example, all the effort and goodwill that forged the great peace was worthwhile. We folk of the commons became better, wiser because of it.
We also supposed it would work in our favor if, when galactic inspectors came to judge us. Warring nations do more harm to a world than those who calmly discuss how best to tend a shared garden. It would surely weigh well that we were courteous and gentle criminals, not rapacious ones. Or so we reasoned, did we not, my rings? Alas, no judges dropped from the sky, but thieves and liars. Suddenly we must play deadly games of intrigue, and those skills are not what they were in days before commons and egg. How much more capable we might have been, if not for peace. We rediscovered this truth with sharp pangs today, when a panting galloper showed up with dispatches from the forged study of Uriel the Smith, words of warning, dire admonitions telling of sky portents, urging that we brace ourselves for visitation by a starship. Oh, tardy premonition! A caution that arrived too late by far. Once stone citadels nestled on bitter cold peaks from north of Byblos all the way down to the tropic settlements of the Vale, flashing messages via cleverly fashioned mirrors, outracing the swiftest Urish couriers or even racing birds. With their semaphore, humans and their allies mobilized speedily for battle, making up skillfully for their lack of numbers. In time, Urs and Hoon developed systems of their own, each clever in its way. Even we Treiki formed a network of scent spore trackers to warn of possible danger. None of these feats survived peace. The semaphore was abandoned, the system of signal rockets allowed to lapse. Until lately, commerce alone simply did not justify such costly media. Though ironically, just last year, investigators had begun speaking of reoccupying those frigid stone Aries, resuming the network of flashed messages. Had they moved faster, would we have received Uriel's warning in time? Would receiving it have made any difference in our fate? Ah, my rings, how vain it is to dwell on might-have-beens. Other than solipsism, it may be the most mad thing that unitary beings waste their time doing.
Ready.
Do you have something for me?
Ron, the tall, stern-looking leader of the sky humans, held out his hand toward her. In the late twilight, with wind rustling a nearby thicket of pale boo, it seemed to Reddy that each of his calloused fingers was like her entire wrist. Moonlight broke out shadows on Ron's craggy figures and wedge-like torso. She tried not to show it, but Reddy felt all too insignificant in his presence.
"Are all men like this, out there among the stars?"
The thought made her feel funny, like earlier when Besh told her it was possible to smooth away her scars. First had come bad news.
"We cannot do anything about it here in our little clinic,"
the Forair woman had told her during Reddy's brief turn at the alien sick call near their buried station. She had been standing in line for half the morning, a horrid wait, spent shuffling between a gekek with a wheezy, lopsided wheel
and an aged Urz whose nostril dripped a ghastly gray fluid. Reddy tried hard not to step in it each time the queue moved forward. When a chance finally came to be examined under bright lights and probing rays, her hopes soared, then crashed. This kind of dermal damage would be easy to repair back home, Besh had said, while ushering Reddy toward the tent flap. Biosculpting is a high art. Experts can mold a pleasant form out of even primitive material. Reddy wasn't offended. Primitive material. It's what I am, all right. Anyway, at the time she was dazed from imagining. What if galactic wizardry could give her a face and body like Besh or Ling? She set her feet, refusing to budge, till Besh let her speak. They say you may take some humans with you when you go. Besh had looked down at her with eyes the color of golden brown gemstones. Who says such things?
I hear stuff, rumors, I guess.
You should not believe all rumors. Had there been extra emphasis on the word all? Reddy leaped on any excuse for hope.
I also hear you pay good when folks bring things you want or news you need.
That much is true. Now the eyes seemed to glitter a little. From amusement or greed?
And if the news is really, really valuable, what'd be the reward then?
The Star Woman smiled, a grin full of friendship and promise.
Depending on how helpful or precious the information, the sky's the limit.
Reddy had felt a thrill. She started to reach into her belt pouch, but Besh stopped her.
Not now, the woman said in a low voice. It is not discreet.
Looking left and right, Reddy realized there were other patients around, and employees of the Forayers, members of the Six serving as assistants in the aliens' many enterprises. Anyone could be a spy for the sages.
Tonight,
Besh had told her in a low voice,
Ron goes walking each evening down by the stream. Wait next to the stand of yellow boo, the one just coming into bloom. Come alone and speak to no one you see along the way.
Great!
Reddy had thought jubilantly on leaving the tent.
They're interested. It's exactly what I was hoping for, and just in the nick of time.
All might have been lost if it had taken much longer to make contact. The chief human sage had decreed she must leave tomorrow, accompanying a small donkey caravan aimed up into the mountains, along with two silent men and three big women she had never met before. Nothing was said, but she knew the goal was to catch up with Dwyer, and from there head back to the wilderness she came from.
No chance of that,
she had thought, relishing tonight's rendezvous. Dwyer's welcome to go play hunter in the forest.
While he's scratching for eats in the gray hills, I'll be living high and mighty up on the dolphin's tail.
That was the constellation where, rumor had it, the Forayers came from, although the crab-like, sage, knife-bright insight once tried explaining to Reddy about galaxies and transfer points, and how the route back to civilization was twisty as a mulk spider's vine. None of it made sense, and she figured the old Kellen was probably lying. Reddy far preferred the idea of going to a star she could clearly see, which meant she would someday look back at Jijo from the beautiful galactic city where she'd gone to live and stick her tongue out every night at Jass and Bomb and their whole stinking tribe. And Dwyer, and the sages, for that matter, along with everyone else on this rancy planet who was ever mean to her.
All day after meeting Besh, she had avoided the sages and their servants, seeking the clearings several arrow flights to the west, where some pilgrims were trying to restore a few of the festivities of gathering. Pavilions that had been taken down in panic were now restored, and many folk had come out of hiding. There was still plenty of tension, but some people seemed determined to get on with life, even if just for a little while. She visited one tent where craft workers showed wares brought from all over the slope. Their goods would have impressed Reddy even yesterday, but now she smiled scornfully, having seen the bright machines the sky humans used. At one panel discussion, she watched Hoon, Gekek, and human experts discuss improved techniques for weaving rope. The atmosphere was hushed, and few in the audience asked questions. Nearby, a Traiki ring breeder displayed some flabby donut shapes with slender arms, eye buds, or stubby feet. A trio of mature Traiki stood near the pen, perhaps pondering additions to a newborn stack they were building back home. Or maybe they were just browsing. Farther along, in a sun-dappled glade, chimp acrobats performed for a crowd of children, and an all-race sextet played by a simmering hot spring. It all might have seemed quite gay if Reddy didn't sense a pall spoiling the mood, and if she had not already hardened her heart to all things Jijoan. "These slopies think they're so much better than a pack of dirty Sooners. Well, maybe it's so, but then everybody on Jijo is a Sooner, ain't they? I'm going far away, so it won't matter to me anymore." In a rougher clearing, she passed much of the afternoon watching human kids and Urish middlings vie in a game of Drake's Dare. The playing field was a strip of sand with a stream along one side. The other border was a long pit filled with coals, smoldering under a coating of gray ash. Wisps of hot smoke wafted into Reddy's face, tugging painful memories of Jass and Bomb. Her scars tightened till she moved a ways uphill, sitting under the shade of a dwarf garu. Two contestants arrived, a human boy starting at the north end of the field, and a burly Urish middling at the south, sauntering and hurling insults as they neared the center, where two umpires waited.
"Hey, Henny, get ready to take a bath,"
the boy taunted, trying to swagger but hindered by his left arm, which was trussed back with cloth bindings. He wore a leather covering from crotch to chin, but his legs and feet were bare. The young Urs had her own protections and handicaps. Tough, transparent Junnur membranes stretched tight over her delicate pouches and scent glands. As the middling drew close, she tried to rear up threateningly, and almost fell over to the amusement of onlookers. Reddy saw the reason. Her hind pair of legs were hobbled together.
"Silly skirl!"
the Urs shouted at her adversary, regaining her balance to hop forward once more.
"Vavy skirl gonna get burned!"
Along both boundaries, beyond the coal bed and across the stream, crowds of other youths gathered to watch. Many wore leather or membrane protectors, hanging jauntily open, while waiting for their own turn in the arena. Some boys and girls smeared salve over livid reddish streaks along their calves and thighs, and even their faces, making Reddy wince. True, none of the burns looked anywhere near as deep or wounding as her own. No blisters or horrid charred patches. Still, how could they risk getting scorched on purpose? The thought both nauseated and queerly fascinated Reddy. Was this so different from her own story, after all? She had known that standing up to Jass would have consequences, yet she did it anyway.
"Sometimes you just gotta fight, that's all."
Her hand lifted briefly to touch her face. She regretted nothing. Nothing.
Some Urish spectators also bore marks of recent combat, especially on their legs, where swathes of fur had gone mangy or sloughed off. Strangely, there wasn't any clear separation along race lines. No human shearing section versus an Urish one. Instead, there was a lot of mixing, preliminary sparring and friendly comparing of techniques and throws. Reddy saw one human boy joke with a middling Urz, laughing with his arm on her sleek mane. A sizable group of Zookirs and chimps screeched at each other in excitement, making wagers of pew nodules and pounding the ground with their hands. Some distance beyond the coals, Reddy saw another makeshift arena being used by juvenile treikis with newly wedded rings, engaged in a different kind of sport with gekek youngsters so light and agile they spun wheelies and even lifted to stride briefly on their rear pusher legs. That tournament seemed to involve a sort of rolling, whirling dance. Reddy couldn't make out the point, but clearly the pastime was less violent than Drake's dare. A pair of Kewan umpires, one gray and one blue, awaited the two contestants in the middle of the sandy strip. They carefully inspected the human sleeve for weapons, then checked the middling's teeth for caps on her scythe-like incisors. The blue Kewan then backed away into the stream, while the gray extended armored legs, and to Reddy's blinking surprise, stepped daintily onto the bed of steaming coals. From then on, it kept shifting its weight, lifting two clawed feet at a time high above the fuming surface, then switching to another pair, and so on. After ritually and warily bowing to each other, the boy and middling began circling, looking for weakness. Abruptly, they sprang at each other, grappling, each trying to push, twist, or throw the other in the direction he or she least wanted to go. Now Reddy saw the reason for the handicaps. With both hind legs tied, the Urz could not stomp her opponent or simply power her way to victory. Likewise, the boy's strong, agile arms might throttle the middling unless one was bound to his side.
"Drake's there! Drake's there! Yippee-yoo-wee!"
The tiny, squeaky voice startled Reddy, coming from much closer than the crowd of shouting onlookers. She swiveled, seeking the source, but saw no one nearby till a tug on her tunic made her look down.
"Pouch safe? Ye talk. You me pouch safe, and ye talk you."
Reddy stared. It was a tiny Urz, no bigger than her foot. It danced delicately on four miniature hooves while still plucking at her garment. The little creature tossed its mane, rotating a sinuous neck to peer around behind it nervously.
"Ye need pouch, ye pouch."
Reddy turned to follow its anxious stare and glimpsed what had it terrified. A sleek black shape crouched in the undergrowth, panting slightly, a lolling tongue hanging between rows of sharp white teeth. At first, Reddy felt a shock of recognition, thinking it was Mudfoot, grouchy old Dwurr's funny companion in the mountains. Then she saw this one had no brown paw patches. A different Nur, then. The predator raised its head and leered at the tiny Urz, taking a step, then another. On impulse, Reddy scooped up the quivering prey and slipped it in her leather hip pouch. The Nur gave her a look of puzzled disappointment, then turned to vanish in the shrubs. Cheers, boos, and excited snorts made her look up in time to see the human contestant tumble through a cloud of billowing ash. To Reddy's amazement, the boy was not instantly set ablaze, but rolled erect, dancing from barefoot to barefoot on the coals, swiftly but calmly brushing embers from crevices in his leather garment. He waved off the gray Kewan, who had hurried protectively to his side. The youth ran a hand along his collar one more time, then sauntered across more glowing cinders back to the sandy arena. Reddy was impressed. Slopey seemed tougher than she'd thought.
Hot, hot, but not much heat.
The little voice squeaked from her pouch, as if pleased by her surprise. All memory of flight from the hungry Noor seemed forgotten.
Boy make boo-boo, slip and fall, but not again, not this boy. He tops, watch silly hinny get wet.
Reddy wrestled with her own amazement, unable to decide which thing dumbfounded her more, the contest below, or the entity in her pocket, providing running commentary. Combat won her attention as the young human launched at his opponent once more. Whatever his mistake the first time, the boy seemed bent on making up for it as he bobbed and weaved, then leaped to catch a handful of the middling's mane. She snorted and snapped, pushing vainly with both slim handling arms to break his grip. She tried lifting a foreleg to tug with its stubby grasping paw, but that just left her teetering dangerously.
"Drake's there!"
the tiny urge shouted gleefully.
"Drake say to Urchun, you me tussle, tussle instead of kill."
Reddy caught her breath.
"Oh, I remember now."
She had heard the legend when she was little, told round the campfire by one of the old grandpas, a tale that died with the old man, since Jas and the young hunters preferred exaggerated retellings of their own exploits over stories of life beyond the mountains. To Reddy's best recollection, there once had been a man named Drac, or Drake, a hero mightier and bolder than any human before or since. Once, when Earthlings were still new on Jijo, a giant Urish chieftain fought Drac in a wrestling match. For 3 days and nights they grappled, pounding and tearing at each other, making the ground shake, drying up rivers, ripping all the countryside between a fiery mountain and the sea, till both volcano and ocean vanished in curling steam. When the clouds finally cleared, a bright region glowed from horizon to horizon with all the colors one could paint by mixing Urish and human blood. Then, out of the smoke and mist, two heroes strode forth, he missing an arm and she a leg, leaning on each other, inseparable from that day forth. While there would be more wars between the tribes, from that day forth all were fought with honor, in memory of Drac and Urchun.
"Watch!"
the little Urs called.
The boy faked a leftward lean, then planted his right foot and heaved. Snorting dismay, the Urs could not keep her greater weight from pivoting over his hip, sailing head over withers to crash into the nearby stream. There came a shrill sigh as she floundered, slipping in the mud. Finally, the blue Kewan surfaced behind her, using one clenched foot to give a helpful shove. With a grateful cry, the middling dove into the sand, raising plumes of dust.
"Hee! Go roll in hot ash, silly hinny! Sand too slow! Hair gonna rot!"
Reddy gazed down at the tiny Urs. It was no baby, as first she thought. Somewhere she recalled hearing that Urish newborns stayed in their mother's pouches for a few months, then were spilled by the dozen into tall grass to fend for themselves. Anyway, infant Urs couldn't talk.
"It must be a male."
Reddy saw that its throat and muzzle looked unlike a female's, lacking the fleshy neck colors or pendulous cloven lip, which explained why it could speak Anglic sounds a female could not. Back in the arena, the boy crouched for a third round, but the Urish youth lowered her head, conceding. The human raised a red-streaked arm in victory, then helped guide the limping loser off the playing field. Meanwhile, two new contestants flexed and stretched, while helpers trussed their handicapped limbs. Wistfully, Reddy watched the human kids, joking with friends from the other septs.
She wondered how the boy had managed to get just slightly singed by the coals, but could not bring herself to approach with questions. They might only laugh at her unkempt hair, her uncouth speech, and her scars.
So forget him anyway, she thought bitterly.
All the dry heat and smoke was making her face itch. In any case, she had important business. An item to retrieve from her tent before dark, something to use as down payment on a ticket away from here, to a place none of these big, handsome kids would ever see, despite all their pride and skill and strutting around. A place where no one from her past would bother her. That was lots more important than watching savages play violent games with fire and water.
Look, I gotta go,
she told the little Irish male, rising to her feet and looking around.
I think the nasty old Noor's gone away, so you can be off now, too.
The tiny creature peered at her, his tail and muzzle drooping. Reddy cleared her throat.
Can I drop you off somewhere? Isn't your, wife probably worried about you?
The dark eyes glittered sadly.
Oof, Roho, need ye no more. Pouch home now, full of slimy new brats, push ye out. Right, Pouch, still husband full. Ye must find new pouch or grass burrow to live, die in. But no sweet grass and mountain, just rocks.
That last was sung mournfully. It sounded like an awful thing to do to a helpless little guy, and Reddy felt mad just thinking about it.
This nice pouch, this one.
He crooned a strange reverberating melody, surprisingly low for a creature so small. Reddy's skin tingled where he lay closest.
Ye serve new wife good, do good things she want.
Reddy stared at him, dazed to think of what he offered. Then she burst out laughing, leaning on a tree, guffawing till her sides hurt. Through clouded eyes she saw that Yi seemed to laugh too, in his own fashion. At last she wiped her face and grinned.
"Well, you done one thing for me already. Ain't chortled so good in I don't know how long. And you know what else? Come to think of it, there is something you might be able to do, something that'd make me even happier."
"Ye do anything. New wife feed ye. Ye make wife happy."
Reddy shook her head, amazed once more at the twists and turns life seemed to push on the unwary. If her new idea worked out, this could turn out to be an awfully lucky break.
"Do you have something for me?"
Ron held out his enormous hand. In the dim twilight, with the yellow boo rustling nearby, Reddy stared at the man's calloused fingers, each like her wrist. His craggy features and massive torso, so much greater than the biggest boy wrestler playing Drake's Dare that day, made her feel callow, insignificant. Reddy wondered,
"Are all men like this, out there among the stars? Could I ever trust anyone with hands like those to have a husband's power over me?"
She had always thought she'd rather die than marry. Yet now she had a husband, purring next to her belly. Reddy felt Yi's warm tongue on her hand as she stroked his silky neck. Ron seemed to note her ironic smile. Did it make her seem more confident? She reached past Yi to pluck a slender object, fluffy at one end, pointy hard at the other, and laid the feather on Ron's open palm. Puzzled, he drew forth an instrument to shine at it from several sides, while her mind still cycled round and round the events leading to this moment, when her hopes hung in the balance. On our way here, Reddy had passed other members of the six, each waiting alone by some landmark along Ron's regular evening stroll. As instructed, no one spoke or made eye contact, though Reddy spied observers, a Gekek, two Hoons, and a human, taking notes from a distance. Reddy didn't give a damn what they told Lester Campbell about her treason. After tonight, the sages wouldn't make plans for her anymore. On arriving at the Yellow Boo, she had waited nervously, petting Yi and biting her fingernails. A few duras before Ron appeared, a soft whine announced one of the mighty robots, eight-sided, intimidating, and a wave of horrid memory recalled another floating monster firing savagely into the Mulk spider's lair, and Dwer's strong arms yanking her out of the path of a searing beam, holding her fiercely against falling, sheltering her with his body. Reddy bit her lip, quashing any thought, any memory that might shake her resolve. Now was no time to go sappy and soft. That was what the sages wanted. As she had done countless times back home, making herself stand up to Jas despite horrid punishments, she had stopped cowering from the dark robot, standing straight, forcing her chin out. "You can't harm me," she projected defiantly. "You wouldn't dare." But an unwelcome thought fizzed up from below. One of these killed the bird. The bird fought it and died. A surge of guilt nearly made her spin around and flee. But then the robot had swerved aside, vanishing into the night, and Ron took its place, holding out his massive hand.
"Do you have something for me?"
he had asked, smiling till Reddy handed over the feather. Now she watched him grow excited as he played instruments over the souvenir, once her prized possession. Pressing lips together, she bore down to reinforce her resolve.
"Hell yes, I have something for you, Mr. Starman. Something I bet you want pretty bad. The point is, you better have something for me, too."
Part 15. The Book of the Sea. The path takes time, so time you must dearly buy. When the lawful seek you, hide. When they find you, be discreet. When you are judged, do not quail. What you have tried to do is rightly banned, but there is a beauty in it, if done well. On this, most agree. The Scroll of Redemption. Alvin's Tale.
"I've got my Anglic Dictionary and Usage Guide with me right now, so I'm going to try an experiment. To capture some of the drama of what happened next, I'm going to try my narrative skill in present tense. I know it's not used in many of the old Earth stories I've read, but when it's done right, I think it lends a buff sense of immediacy to a story. Here goes. I left off with little Ziz, the Treiki partial we all witnessed being Vlend a week ago, on the day Gibiz turned herself into Teug and forgot all about starships, slithering its way from Penn to Derek, where we were about to test the Bathy for the first time. Ziz had spent the last week voring a rich feed mix and had grown a lot. Still, it made a pretty short stack. Nobody expects miracles of strength or brilliance from a half-pint treiki that barely reaches my bottom set of knees. Ziz follows Teug's centimone trail almost to the edge of the cliff, where you can stare straight down into the great midden as it takes a sharp hook, stabbing the continent with a wound so deep and wide,
Our ancestors chose it as a natural boundary for settler life on Jijo. The towering bulk of Terminus Rock casts a long morning shadow, but Wufan's dream, our pride and joy, dangles just beyond, shimmering in a blaze of sunlight. Instead of slithering up the ramp to the sealed cabin hatch, Ziz glides into a little cage mounted under the bulb window in front of 18 heavy ballast stones. As it passes Tug, Ziz and the full-size Treiki exchange puffs of vapor, in a language no other member of the six is equipped to even try to understand. The cage closes. Erdonal whistles a call, and gangs of Hoon and Kewans set to work, first swinging the Bathy gently away, then lowering it toward the sea, unreeling both the taut hawser and the double hose. The drums turn to a slow, steady beat, singing over and over, rumble-dum-dumble-um, rumble-dum-dumble-um. It draws us. Hoon all over the mesa, even protesters, get caught up in the pulse-like cadence of joyful labor, a rhythm of teamwork, sweat, and a job underway. Being the only Noor present, Hufu seems to think it her duty to scamper like a wild thing, taking perches high on the derricks like their ship masts, arching her back and stretching as if the umbel is being sung just for her, a physical hand petting her back, stroking the bristles on her head. Her eyes sparkle, watching our Bathy dip lower and lower, with Ziz visible as a single tentacle dangling from the wire cage. It occurs to me that maybe Hufu thinks the little Treiki is being used as bait at the end of a really big fishing line. Maybe Hufu's curious what we're trying to catch. That, in turn, brings to mind Pincer's wild tales of monsters in the deep. Neither he nor Huck has mentioned a word about it since we arrived, each for his or her own reasons, I guess. Or am I the only one who hasn't forgotten amid all the recent excitement? Wufan's dream descends below the cliff face, and we rush near the edge to keep her in sight. Kewans don't like heights and react by hunkering down, scraping their abdomens, clutching the ground. That's where I go, too, lying prone and screwing up my courage to slide forward. Huck, on the other hand, just rolls up to the stony rim, teeters with her pusher legs jutting back for balance, then sticks two of her eye stalks over as far as they'll go. What a girl! So much for Gekek's being cautious, high-K beings. Watching her, I realize I can't do any less, so I creep my head over the rim and force my eyelids apart. Looking west, the ocean is a vast carpet stretching to a far horizon. Pale colors dominate where the sea covers only a few cables' depth of continental shelf, but a band of dark blue-gray tells of a canyon stabbing our way from the giant planetary scar called the Midden. That deep, deep gorge passes almost directly under our Aerie, then drives on farther east, splitting the land like a crack in the clinker boards of a doomed ship. The far shore is just 100 or so arrow flights away, but rows of razor-sharp crags and near-bottomless ravines parallel the rift, making it a daunting barrier for anyone wishing to defy the law. I'm no scientist, regrettably. I don't have the mind for it. But even I can tell the jagged spires must be new, or else wind and surf and rain would have worn them down by now. Like Mount Gwen, this is a place where Jijo is actively renewing itself. We felt two small quakes in setting up camp here. No wonder some think Terminus Rock a sacred spot. The surf is a crashing, spuming show elsewhere, but here the sea settles down mysteriously, glassy smooth,
A slight out-toe draws gently away from the cliff. Ideal conditions for our experiment, if they're reliable. No one ever thought to make soundings in the rift before, since no draw ships ever come this way. Wu Fan's dream drops lower, like a spider fly trailing twin filaments behind her. It gets hard to tell exactly how far she is from the surface. Huck's eye stalks are spread as far apart as possible, trying to maximize depth perception. She murmurs,
"Okay, here we go, into the drink. Now."
I hold my breath. But nothing happens. The big drums keep feeding out cable and hose. The bathy gets smaller.
"Now," Huck repeats.
Another dura passes, and Wu Fan's dream is still dry.
"Sure is a long way down, own, own,"
Pincer stutters.
"You can say that again,"
adds Urron, stamping nervously.
"But please don't,"
Huck snaps, showing peak. Then in Gal 6,
"Reality merges with expectation when..."
It serves her right. A splash cuts off whatever deep insight she was about to share. The big drum's song slows and deepens as I stare across the vast, wet stillness where the dream vanished. Roomble doom, doomble loom, roomble doom, doomble. It sounds like the world's biggest hoon. One who never has to take a break or a breath. Based on that umble, the big Derek would have won the title of honorary captain of the South if it came to a vote then and there. Hufu is all the way out at the end of the deployer crane, back arched with pleasure. Meanwhile, someone counts off.
"One cable 40, one cable 60, one cable 80, two cables 20.
The chant reminds me of Mark Twain's tales of river pilots on the romantic Mississippi, especially one scene with a big black man human up at the bow of the Delta Princess, swinging a weight on a line, calling out shoals in a treacherous fog, saving the lives of everyone aboard. I'm an ocean hoon. My people sail ships, not sissy boats. Still, those were among my father's favorite tales. And Huck's, too, back when she was a little orphan, toddling around on her pusher legs, four eyes staring in lost wonder as Dad recited tales set on a wolfling world that never knew the stifling wisdom of galactic ways. A world where ignorance wasn't exactly noble, but had one virtue. It gave you a chance to see and learn and do things no one else had ever seen or learned or done before. Humans got to do that back on Earth. And now we're doing it here. Before I even know I'm doing it, I sit up on my double-fold haunches, rock my head back, and belt out an umble of joy. A mighty rolling hoot. It resounds across the mesa, strokes the grumbling equipment, and floats over the serrated stones of the Great Rift. For all I know, it's floating out there still. Sunshine spills across the calm waters, at least 20 cables deep. We imagine Wu Fan's dream drifting ever downward, first through a cloud of bubbles, then a swollen wake of silence, as the light from above grows dimmer and finally fails completely.
"Six cables 60, six cables 80, seven cables."
When we go down, this is where we'll turn on the Ike lights and use the acid battery to send sparks up the hawser, telling those above that all is well.
but Ziz has no lights or any way to signal. The little stack is all alone down there, though I guess no Treyiki ever feels entirely lonely. Not when its rings can argue endlessly among themselves.
8 cables?
Someone brings a jar of wine for me and some warm Simla blood for Uron. Huck sips pungent galookade from a long, curvy straw, while Pincer sprays his back with salt water.
9 cables?
This experiment's only supposed to go to 10, so they begin gently increasing pressure on the brake. Soon they'll reverse the drums to bring Wufan's dream back to the world of air and light. Then it happens. A sudden twang, like a plucked violin string, loud as thunder. The deployer chief cries,
"Release the brake!"
An operator leaps for a lever. Too late, as bucking convulsions hit the derrick like backlash on a fishing pole when a big one gets away. Only this recoil is massive, unstoppable. We all gasp or vert at the sight of Hufu, a small black figure clinging to the farthest spar as the crane whips back and forth. One paw, then another, loses its grip. She screams. The tiny Nor goes spinning across space, barely missing the Hauser cyclone whirl amid a frothing patch of sea. Staring in helpless dismay, we see our mascot plunge into the abyss that already swallowed Ziz, Wufan's dream, and all the hopes and hard work of 2 long years.
Part 16. The Book of the Slope. Legends. The Urs tell of a crisis of breeding. Out among the stars, they were said to live longer than they do on Jijo, with spans much enhanced by artificial means. Moreover, an Urs never stops wanting a full pouch, tenanted either with a husband or with brooding young. There were technical ways to duplicate the feeling, but to many these methods just weren't the same. Galactic society is harsh on overbreeders who threaten the billion-year-old balance. There is constant dread of another wildfire, a conflagration of overpopulation like the one that burned almost half the worlds in Galaxy 3 100 or so million years ago. Especially those species who reproduce slowly, like Hoon, seem to have a deep-set fear of low-K spawners, like Urs. Legend tells of a conflict over this matter. Reading between the lines of ornate Urish oral history, it seems the bards must be telling of a lawsuit, one judged at the higher levels of galactic society. The Urs lost the suit, and a bitter war of enforcement that followed. Some of the losers did not wish to settle even then. They turned one ship toward forbidden spaces, there to search for a wild prairie they could call home, a place to hear the clatter-clatter of myriad little Urish feet. Asks.
A strange message has come all the way from Tariktown, sent by Ariana Fu, Emeritus High Sage of Human Sept. The exhausted Urish runner collapsed to her knees after dashing uphill from the Warrel Plain, so spent that she actually craved water, raw and undiluted. Center now, my rings. Spin your ever-wavering attention round the tale of Ariana Fu, as it was read aloud by Lester Campbell, her successor. Did not the news send vaporous wonder roiling through my our core? That a mysterious, injured outlander showed up one day near the Upper Roni?
a stranger who might possibly be some lost comrade of the star god visitors who now vex our shared exile. Or else, she speculates, might he be one who escaped these far-raiding adventurers? Could his wounds show evidence of shared enmity? Ariana recommends we of the Council cautiously investigate the matter at our end, perhaps using truth scryers, while she performs further experiments at Byblos. The forayers do seem to have other interests beyond seeking pre-sentient species to ravish from Jijo's fallow peace. They